I'm David Albrecht with Ravi Satyam, and you're listening to Engineers on Stage, an R&D.io production. Engineers on Stage pulls back the curtain to reveal the people and stories behind today's most exciting developments in science and technology. Discussion, further interviews, and transcripts are available on our website at rnd.io. Tonight's March 16th. Our guest tonight on Engineers on Stage is Andrew Lee. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good.
That's great, man.
Thanks for having me on.
Cool. I met Andrew because the two of us are roommates. There was a guy who used to live here in the apartment, right? He was at a co-working space called Door House, where I worked for a while, right? And what was his name? I don't even remember.
It was Robert Steffes.
Okay, but he moved out, right?
Yeah, he worked with my friend Rishi at a company called Flying Cart.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I actually know Rishi. He has a crazy engagement story to his wife, so it's cool.
Yes. The only guy I know who successfully got his fiance to pay him during the engagement process.
What?
It's pretty incredible. So you're from Minnesota originally, right?
Yes. Twin Cities.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing, man. We're out here in San Francisco. You got into engineering, though, right? So I always ask, like, what's the story there? Like, how did you know you wanted to do electrical engineering, right?
You know, that's a long story. So my family's always been very technical. My dad was a programmer. Growing up, we had computers everywhere. At one point, I think we had 22 computers in my house.
Wow.
And, damn.
During high school, actually, my dad decided this internet thing was kind of cool, so we should start our own ISP. So we had a high-speed line in my house starting in, like, 1998.
Okay.
And I was the sysadmin. So
like a T1, or what was it?
It was an ISDN. I think it was like a
dual channel, like
I think
128.
It was a dual channel 128 ISDN.
Okay.
Back when everyone else had their, you know, 9600 baud modems.
Okay. So you could fit like how many, 12 of them on there, or maybe 14 simultaneously?
So we didn't do that. Well, we did do dial up, but we didn't focus on that. We were mainly like web hosting.
Oh, I see.
Types of things.
Okay.
And I did the sysadmin work for that, so I learned FBSD and how to set up web servers and all that stuff from my dad.
When you were like 12 years old.
Maybe a little older, but yeah, high school, like early high school.
Okay, so that's pretty cool. So you guys were selling web hosting, you said?
Yeah, we sold web hosting, and I did a little bit of programming, but mostly through people my dad introduced me to.
Okay, cool. And then, so you guys must have had a bunch of customers. How many did you have, like 50 or 100 or a lot?
I don't remember, not very many.
Okay.
I don't think the business has ever... The original intention of the business was to pay for the ISDN line.
Oh,
so
I see.
My dad could have awesome internet. And I think it did a little better than that, but...
Cool.
It was never a full-time job for him.
I see.
No, were there technology classes at your high school and stuff? Or how did you pick up programming?
You know, I think there was a C class. I never took it. I had a friend, Clayton Williams, who I think David actually knows.
I actually do,
and
yeah.
He... My brother did some programming, but it wasn't until my freshman year of high school when I met him... And he was already into programming that I really started, you know, thinking about.
Clayton, right?
Time. Clayton Williams.
Yeah, he was at Amazon for a while. I know him from Seattle and University of Illinois as well, right? Which is
where
Ravi and I both went to college. So
yeah, and he had a game called Blob Fighter.
Okay.
Which was like, it had like these three circles. It was like a snowman type thing. It was like a graphical game back in like the Mac OS 8 days.
Sure.
And he had this little fighter game, and I decided that, you know, I can do better than Blob Fighter, and I built something silly, and then he built something sillier, and
sure,
that's kind of how it started, I think.
So, did your parents do the ISDN thing? It was mostly a side thing, right? Like, what they had normal jobs, right?
Yeah. So my dad worked at Cray, I think.
Supercomputing, right?
Yeah, and he's worked at several in that industry, but he's been focused on the supercomputer industry.
Cool.
For a long time.
Sure. Okay. Cool. So then you ended up at Rose Holman after that. What was that process, like deciding where to go to college?
You know, that was a long time ago.
Okay.
My cousin Jay, who now has a startup as well, he had gone out there. So we knew of it through him. And then my brother had considered it when he went to school. And I applied to three schools.
Okay.
I applied to Iowa State, MIT, and Rose.
Okay.
I got rejected from MIT.
I also got rejected from MIT.
High five.
And applied to three schools. High five.
We had actually that's funny. When I was in Malaysia last fall, I discovered that me and my friend and the guy we were staying with had all also been rejected from MIT. So it's a good bonding experience. But I got rejected from MIT, and I went and I visited Iowa State, and I was very much not impressed. And so at that point, I only had one option.
Which is Rose.
So I went to Rose.
And it's in the Midwest, but it's not like next door, right? Because you're originally from Minnesota, but Rose is in Indiana.
That was a good 10-hour drive. Yeah.
Okay. From home. that's pretty far.
Did you do computer science at Rose Hulman? Or?
I started out doing computer science, and then I had a lot of credit coming in. I took like 8 AP tests in high school.
Yeah, I had like 6, I think.
Which was, it's the cheapest way to get college credit. You pay $60 or whatever for the test, and then you skip a couple quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some free time to work with, and I worked too hard, so I added a double E as well.
Nice. Oh, okay. So you had CS and double E.
Yeah, I had a double major.
Okay, because you had mentioned that you did electrical engineering, but also CS as well, huh?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so all three of us have some form of electrical engineering degree, which is kind of fun. So that's good. So any good stories from there? Like, what's the culture there like? I know you said one time that like a lot of people go on to work jobs out of school there, right? Like, not a big startup school, I guess, or like what's it
yeah.
like?
Yeah, it's a very engineering focused school. That's okay. all they do. And they focus primarily on hardware type stuff. They have a very good mechanical engineering program and double E program, civil program, and less so on the software. I discovered after I got there, that the software wasn't really their strength, which is one of the reasons I chose double E, because I wanted to take advantage of what their strengths were. And they don't really have that much of a startup culture, although they do have an incubator associated with it, but they're mostly kind of a feeder into some of the big tech companies.
I see.
So doing double E, what were your favorite classes at Rose Hulman?
Yeah, I mean, what did you do in college? Like, did you go to class a lot, or did you work?
I did go to the classes. As far as what was my favorite to attend, I think one of them would have been an analog electronics class, and that's mainly because the teacher was hilarious.
Okay.
He was one of these guys that talked really, really quietly, but had a lot of really dry humor, so the whole class was just dead silent the whole time, because nobody wanted to miss the jokes.
I see.
And it worked really well.
That's fantastic.
And he found a way to use every time he'd introduce a new topic, you know, here's how to use a MOSFET or some new component, he'd introduce it with, this is how we will use this new, you know, component or idea to generate high voltage.
Oh,
and
I see.
So he had...
So he would link stuff to real-world applications.
Right, very practical things, like, here's how to shock people with this circuit configuration. Here's
That's great.
And one of those I actually built myself. I took one of the ideas that he had, and I built a solar-powered taser, essentially, which I then gave to my parents to shock the dogs in our yard. It worked. It was pretty...
Okay.
It could take a chunk of metal off a doorknob. It was pretty awesome.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, before I get to that, I actually threatened my roommate with it to make sure that he was up in time for lab.
Okay. Was it like 8 a.m. or something really early?
It was an early lab, yeah. So I was like, you either get up or I'll wake you up myself.
It's a little bit evil.
Is Rose Hulman like primarily an engineering school, or do you guys have like a business and arts and sciences wing? And stuff? I don't know actually much about the university, so I'm kind of curious.
That's all they do. It's all engineering.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot of guys too, right? Like not too many women at the school.
Like 88% male.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Like that. Very, yeah. very heavily male. It used to be all male until maybe like 10 years before I was there, it was all male.
Huh.
And then there were a few women when I was there. But
kind of like Silicon Valley.
way more so. Way okay. more so, yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt right at home, you know, here and like at YC, because it's the same kind of thing.
Sure. So then you came over to Urbana a couple times. You mentioned this to me, right?
Yeah, I was
like,
over there relatively...
For Reflections Projections, right?
Yeah, relatively often, actually. I think I still have a shirt, maybe.
No kidding.
From that. So my friend Clayton went to UIUC,
yeah.
and the computer science program there is actually, it's definitely much bigger, and I think it might be better.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of events there, so I got to go to the competitions.
Okay.
I think
you did the robotics competition, right?
Oh, did you do the Jerry Sanders competition?
No, I did. There was an AI competition where you like write an AI for this game and they'd fight with each other. And we did a couple of like ACM competitions there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
I was over there and we just went to some of the job fairs. The job fairs at UIUC were pretty good.
Okay. Cool. So did you intern at all, like when you were in college?
Yeah, I had one every year. So
okay,
the first year I went, I worked at a startup in Indianapolis.
Okay,
that was doing medical device sales software. It was like a CRM for people doing medical device sales.
Okay.
And it was called No Ink. And that was my first real job, I guess, outside of McDonald's.
Is that after your freshman year?
Yeah, after my freshman year.
So you never worked in high school or anything?
No, I had a normal people jobs.
You worked at McDonald's.
I worked at McDonald's. I was a gymnastics coach. I had paper route.
Okay.
I worked on a farm, like picking vegetables.
That's awesome.
I've had a job since I was 12 doing all kinds of random things. I did a bunch of consulting work. Like when I was old enough to do stuff with computers, I did that because it paid better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably missing a bunch of jobs that I had in there.
Yeah, I did that too. I was like a golf caddy for a long time and did like computer work too when I was in high school.
You got a scholarship off of that.
So. Yeah, I did. Whole different story.
My parents kept telling me to caddy. My siblings caddy. They're like, yeah, you can get a scholarship. I never did though.
Yeah, that's all right. So I guess you worked at that company after your freshman year, right? That was in Indiana. And that was like a software job, right?
Yeah, I was I was an intern in charge of testing, and they had a product with a GUI. Which it turns out is very hard to test in an automated fashion, so they just threw interns at it.
We deal with this problem a lot at Wishery, actually. Automated testing of GUIs.
I wish you had some interns to throw at it.
Yeah, I actually do, yeah.
And it was an interesting experience. My first day on the job, I met with my boss, and he gave me this manual that talked about how all their software worked and told me to read it.
A manual.
It was like 300 pages.
Who the hell has a manual?
And I went back to my desk and I sat down and I promptly fell asleep.
You seriously fell asleep at work?
I fell asleep on my desk first day in the job.
Awesome.
And I was woken up by my manager that day. And I went home that day convinced that I was going to be fired and trying to figure out how I was going to pay back my friend Andy, who had just lent me the money to put the down payment on the apartment I just rented. But I had no money.
That's awesome. So then what did you do after that? You said you had an internship every year. So what was your sophomore year one?
Yeah, the second year I worked at Adobe.
Oh, okay. Where, in Seattle? Or
no, in Minnesota, actually. Just north of St. Paul. They bought out a company. I forget which company they bought out, but they had a company office with about 70 people there.
Okay.
And I had... That was actually a great job. I had a private office as an intern.
No kidding.
And lots of very nice people there, and it paid really well. They paid double overtime, and they let me work as much overtime as I wanted.
So you were working like an hourly job?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't know that I keep saying Seattle because Adobe has an office in Seattle, but Adobe does hourly billing. I didn't actually know that.
For the interns.
Oh, I see.
I doubt the full-time people are like that, but I was an intern and I was special, and somehow they thought it was logical to pay me that way, and it was great because I made a bunch of money off overtime.
I see. Yeah, because you worked a lot. What project were you working on?
I worked on Photoshop. So
no kidding.
I don't know if I'm still in there, but at one point, if you looked in the credits for Photoshop, I was listed.
And I know they credit everybody in Photoshop, right? It's not like a corporate authored product.
Yeah. It's a long list of names.
That's kind of uncommon. I think most software companies don't do that. They don't acknowledge like every single person that's worked on the product, right?
And I think they should.
Yeah, I think they should too.
I actually insisted on that. I don't know if I would have been in that, but when I showed up, I said, "Do I get to be in the credits?" I said yes, and then I emailed them several times afterwards just to make sure.
Yeah,
and I made sure that I got my free copy.
Yeah,
so
that's cool. It's a nice product too. Like Photoshop, obviously, it's very ubiquitous. So then, what after that? Like, what did you do after Adobe?
The next summer, I had another offer to go back to Adobe, but I wanted to do something different, so I went and worked for Seagate in Colorado.
Okay, so that's a little further away, right? Because you were in, remind me, Indianapolis, and then where was Adobe?
It was in Minnesota. I lived at home that summer.
I see.
That was convenient.
Okay. So then were you in Colorado, Boulder, or Colorado Springs?
Just north of Boulder in Longmont.
Okay.
So I spent a lot of time in Boulder that summer.
Okay.
And I worked there in the team that builds the control systems for the heads for the hard drive.
For hard drives. Okay, cool. So that's probably a little more electrical engineering, I imagine.
That was what I thought it would be.
Did you do embedded stuff, or what did you do?
I wrote MATLAB code.
Oh, no. Okay.
I picked it mainly because I wanted to try to flex my double E muscle a little bit to see, when I got my full-time job, if I wanted to go in that direction or not.
I see.
And I ended up writing a lot of MATLAB code, a lot of MATLAB GUI code, which was kind of painful. But I had some pretty fun projects, too. I got to do like some R&D type stuff, doing some analysis they'd never done before.
What were you doing in MATLAB? Like some kind of signal processing, or what was it?
So they, it turns out that building a hard drive is a very interesting thing.
Yeah, it turns out that it's really hard, isn't it?
Every hard drive, when it comes off the line, is actually different. They have like individual different like performance characteristics, and they actually generate the control like parameters after they've been assembled. So they come out of the machine, and they already have code, you know, flashed onto the drives, and they use that to test the drives for performance metrics and then generate the control parameters.
I see. CPUs do this a bit too, I think, but it's mostly around the clocking, right?
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did.
Yeah, I think they do. I think they do some verification routines, and then depending on like how high of a frequency they can verify, they clock it that way, I think.
Yeah, and they put them in. Yeah, and they put them in different bins, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They do the same thing with hard drives. I think it's a fair bit more elaborate though.
Because it seems so. Yeah,
they not only do they quantify, you know, is this one good or is that one good? They actually tune a lot of variables to make sure that it's as good as it can be.
I see.
And they also do things like they go around, they test the drive, and they find the bad sectors. So every hard drive has this long, you know, hours long process of validating and like optimizing itself before they ship it.
So disks ship from the manufacturer with some bad sectors on them. That's interesting. Is it just for manufacturing defects?
They all do. Just manufacturing. There's a lot of like very tight tolerances in hard drives, and there's material problems.
I mean, yeah, like the individual magnetization zones are probably like microns or even nanometers across, right?
Very, very small. I don't know the exact dimensions, but
they're tiny.
They're constantly trying to make them smaller. Mm-hmm. So when I was there, they were in the process of going from like horizontal recording to vertical recording. Like the orientation of the magnetic fields and the disks were changing because the limiting factor had become the magnetization of the material itself was getting, the bits were getting too close together and the magnetization wasn't holding. So they had to change the orientation of the fields.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. So then with the disk controllers, like if they have bad sectors on them, do they present that to the operating system or does the disk just hide that?
Disk just hides it.
Wow.
Yeah, they take care of that internally. So what I was actually doing there was...
Do they perform fault tolerance as well, I bet, right? The disk, if there are bad sectors, I mean, does it try to presume the data on them? Or
I don't think it writes any data there at all, right?
Yeah, I think it just writes somewhere in some, you know, in some table.
Some separate space.
That these spec sectors shouldn't be used, and it just skips over those, doesn't address them.
Or what were you saying you're mentioning about disks, I think, right?
Yeah, I was just saying what I was working on that summer. I was helping them store and process their own analytics because the team I worked with were the guys who wrote the logic for the control software. So it was some fairly standard like EE control systems, but at very high frequencies and a very small scale. And they needed to get diagnostics of when they put out a new control algorithm, how it performed, and all that. So
yeah,
I spent my time helping them sort of do analysis on that data and then store it off to disk.
And MATLAB is pretty widely used by people that aren't necessarily software engineers but have to do a lot of analysis, right?
It is.
Like mechanical engineers and electrical engineers, those kinds of people.
Even
right?
In finance, actually, I've seen people use MATLAB.
It's a very easy way to do lots of number crunching.
That's interesting.
There's a lot of functions built in if you want to do matrix math. It's very easy to do that sort of thing.
I see. So then what did you do after that? So that would have been your junior year. So did you graduate and then you started working right after that?
Yeah. So
you went to Green Hills, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting place. Like not very well known by people, I don't think. Like most people have never heard of it, I imagine.
Probably not. No.
Yeah.
Now, Green Hills is near Los Angeles or something, right?
Yeah, it's down south.
So you came out all the way to the West Coast, huh?
Yeah, I got recruited by them when I was at Rose, and they did a great job of building buzz around their company.
They have a big presence in Illinois as well. I remember that.
Yeah, you mentioned that they make you take a test, I think, like just to work there.
Yeah.
You have to take a written test.
You have to take a written test.
That's impressive.
When they did that at the time, I almost didn't apply because I thought I was kind of above that. You know, why should I have to take a test? I just spent 4 years going to school. Why should I do this? And it turns out it's actually a really good thing for the company to do this.
Okay.
They not only do they do a good job of vetting people, but also helps to build culture because
You guys do this too at your company.
We do this now. Yeah,
we'll get to that.
It works so well that we're copying that. It does two things. One is it helps you find the good people, but it also once you get inside there, it helps build culture because on day one, everyone has this shared experience of having done this test, and so it means that. And the test is pretty hard. There's two sections. There's a written portion, and then there's actually when they fly you out. They sit you down in front of a computer for 6 hours, and they make you build a real program. And
6 hours?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And it has to work, right? So and it's automatically tested. So you build this thing. If it doesn't pass their automatic validation, you're not getting hired. But what that means is everyone who does get hired, you know that they're at least good enough to do that test, and the test is hard.
Yeah, they have some minimal like programming or coding ability, right?
Yeah, and so you trust
people. I mean, I've gone through their test, and I've actually taken this test myself during the first round when they came to our university, and you know they made you take this. I think it was an hour-long test or whatever in the first round itself. And the questions there, you know, you had to have a well-rounded view of computer science in general. You know, you didn't know your basic algorithms, computer architecture, some embedded systems knowledge, so...
The one I took, they actually made up an imaginary programming language, and they ask you to execute this language. You know, they explained how it worked, and then they gave you sample code and said, what would this do? And if I remember it, it was a language where the instructions weren't supposed to be executed until after the variables were defined, but the variables could be defined afterwards.
So it supported, like, lazy loading, or...
It was lazy declaration of variables. So you'd say, like, it would start, like, you know, print line, you know, A plus B, right? Mm-hmm. And then it would define A, and then it would define B. And when B was defined, it was supposed to immediately print that line.
Oh, I see.
And so the order of operations got really strange, and you had to figure out exactly how they get printed.
Yeah, they're complicated dependencies, right?
So, yep.
Coming back to Green Hills, now, we know what Seagate does, and we know what Adobe does. So why don't you, I guess, describe to us what Green Hills does and what you did there.
They build tools for embedded systems. They have an operating system. They have an IDE. They have compilers. They started out as a compiler company, but at this point, I think their big business actually is virtualization software, which is one of the pieces I worked on when I was there.
How many people work there? Like hundreds or thousands?
Hundreds. I don't know today. When I was there, I think there were up 200 engineers.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a medium-sized company.
Yeah. How did you feel about moving to California?
I was a big fan. So that was actually a large part of the reason I picked that job. I was the buzz that they built when I was being recruited was a helping part of that. But I had offers from Amazon and Microsoft and you know some other smaller companies, and none of them were in sunny Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And I stepped off the plane. I remember it was January it was December when I went out there, and I had driven, you know, way too fast through a blizzard to get to the airport in Indiana, and it was the worst blizzard I'd ever seen in Indiana. Like, there were cars lining the sides of the road, and I was like terrified to be driving in this thing, and I almost missed my flight, but I didn't, because the plane itself was delayed from the blizzard. And I fly up to California, and I remember I get off the plane and I get met by a recruiter there, and it's like 55 degrees and sunny.
This is for your interview or when you started?
For the interview. And the first thing the recruiter says to me is, I'm sorry for the bad weather. Referring to the 55 degrees that it was in December.
Oh, in California.
In California.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. He said, you have no idea.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially coming from Minnesota, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so then, so you were there for like a year and a half, I think. So what did you work on?
So I worked in their AP group, their Advanced Products group, which does sort of their consulting work.
Okay.
They have two sides. One actually builds their products, and then their side tailors those products to specific companies.
Okay.
And so I did sort of hired gun work to modify the operating system or to build new device drivers or to port their code. And I worked on a bunch of projects like at the, you know, in the OS level, like right, device drivers. I also worked on their virtualization software. They have sort of a high security virtualization hypervisor that they use for like military and government work.
I see. And was this mostly x86 stuff, or like what was that? What was the architecture?
I didn't do much on x86. I did a lot with ARM. I worked with a processor called ARC.
Yeah, I saw that. I was looking at the Wikipedia article on the company, and I saw something about ARC. I don't know much about it.
Yeah, ARC's, it's for people who can't afford an ARM licensing fee, basically.
Oh, I see.
And it's not great. I had fun with that. So I did a bunch of different chips. I didn't do much until I started doing the virtualization stuff. I didn't do much with x86.
Okay.
But I did do some work on those machines once I started doing virtualization.
Okay. That's cool. So then you were there for about a year and a half, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Why'd you leave?
I had been planning on doing the startup the whole time.
Okay. So you were just kind of waiting.
I moved to California. They paid very well, so I was able to save up some money. I was able to learn a bit about California and the industry, and when I had the money I needed, I quit my job.
Oh, okay. So you were ready to go at that point?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's good. So then, you know, you mentioned that you'd saved a fair bit of money, and you did some options trading, I think, or some kind of like financial thing for a while.
I did. I started trading when I was at Seagate, actually, as an intern.
Okay.
And I thought Seagate was doing very well, so I bought some stock, and I made money off that purchase. So I thought this is a great idea. So I started trading as, you know, as soon as I had money to play with.
It's kind of, Andrew, it's kind of amazing just listening to you talk about this stuff. I also did like a little bit of securities trading when I worked at Microsoft, which is also a big tech company, you know, and like just coming from the Midwest as well. It's just funny to see these parallels. I don't know. It's funny. So you did like stock trading, and then I guess you did some options trading as well, right?
I did. So I started just in the stocks world, and I got a little overconfident thinking I knew what I was doing.
Okay.
And I started trading options, and for a long time I did fairly well with that.
Okay. What strategies were you using, like briefly? Anything in particular?
I tried to pick tech companies I thought I understood.
I see.
For the most part, and when I thought they were going to do well, I'd buy, and when I thought they weren't going to do well, I'd sell it.
Okay.
I tended to like to play what I thought were like overcompensations in the news. When something bad happens, mm-hmm. often the stock will swing way lower than it should,
mm-hmm. or way higher,
or something good way higher, and I would try to catch what I felt was over exuberance or you know, too much fear, and I'd try to, you know, make some
money. Exploit that, sure. Yeah, because I mean the underlying value of like the company doesn't change that much day to day. Okay, that's cool. Okay, so then after you left Green Hill, you stayed in California, right? Now you were in Santa Barbara or Santa Monica? Remind me.
Santa Barbara. It's about an hour and a half, mostly west from LA. The coast curves out there, and it's sort of the last big suburb of, you know, the giant city that is LA.
Okay. That's Santa Barbara, right?
Barbara.
Yeah, okay.
It's a beautiful little town on the beach.
Okay. So then you you went and started a company after that, and it was a hardware company, if I remember properly.
That's right.
Okay. And then your co-founder, James, was he working with you at the time?
So yeah, so James was with me from the very beginning.
Awesome.
So before I quit my job, so after I'd been at Green Hills about a year,
okay.
I was getting close to having the money I needed.
So James was working at Green Hill as well?
No, he wasn't. I know James from high school, actually.
Oh, okay.
A long, long time ago. So I was working at Green Hills. I'd saved up the money I needed, and I was getting ready to quit. Mm-hmm. And so I went and I called up all of my friends who I thought would want to do a startup with me. And I went through the whole list, and they all said definitively no.
I had a similar experience when I left Microsoft, actually. I just went through like my whole Rolodex, you know, and there were a couple people that were like maybe vaguely interested, but they all had jobs, and they're all like, "What is this? You know, why would I do that?"
Yep.
It's risk aversion, man. It's the Midwest.
It is. So I had, you know, and I had been, you know, trying to talk some of these guys into this a long time, and it wasn't working. And I asked my brother, and I asked all these people, and I couldn't get anyone.
Like engineers mostly, or who were they?
Yeah, engineers. Okay. You know, people from college, people from, you know, from high school, family, and I got no's from everybody.
Okay.
And, you know, I spent a couple months doing this, and I also thought I had an idea, and I believe at the time the idea wasn't even the hardware company, it was a completely different idea.
Okay.
And one weekend I was home in Minnesota just visiting my parents, and I called my friend James just to see if any of my high school friends were still in town.
Okay.
And he happened to be there just for one night visiting his parents. He was home from Wisconsin. He went to school in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And we went to Applebee's, and we caught up. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, one night, and I told him I was going to do a startup, and he said, "Great, I was thinking about doing a startup too."
Okay.
And at that point, I said, "This could be fun." You know, James and I got along well in high school.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really caught up, you know, stayed up in touch with him that well during college. But I thought, hey, you know,
sure,
let's give it a shot.
What was he doing at the time?
He was still in grad school.
So he went to graduate school. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he got a master's in industrial engineering.
Okay.
So his expertise is in sort of designing processes.
Mm-hmm. And then is he from the UK or
yeah,
what?
He's British. He moved to the US when he was 12.
Okay.
Initially, and he's been back and forth a couple times since.
Okay. Hmm. So where was he at graduate school? Somewhere in Wisconsin or around there?
Yeah. So he went to Wisconsin-Madison.
Okay. UWM, as it's known, right? Or Wisconsin-Madison,
yes.
I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
He also spent some time over in the UK during that. I think he spent a year over in the UK during that period.
I see. Cool. So you guys met at the Applebee's. It's just funny. It's Applebee's, right?
Yeah.
You went to the restaurant and then you talked for a little while. And you did you know he was in town or you just called him randomly?
I just got totally random. I didn't know. God, totally random. Amazing. Just got lucky.
Yeah, that's a while ago. So he said he was looking at doing something similar. So did he move to California then eventually? Or?
So at that point, this was in, I think, September. And okay. I was planning to quit in December.
Okay.
And he wanted to do some traveling.
Okay.
And I didn't want to wait. So I said, fine, go do your traveling. You know, I'll start the company right away in okay. December when I quit my job. And then when you get back, you can join me.
Okay.
So I quit in mid-December. Okay. And this is actually kind of a funny story. We had been planning on building a service for... I believe this was a marketplace for expertise where you could like find an expert online and you'd pay them by the hour and they would like Skype with you and tell you what you wanted to know.
I think that was part of the rationale behind eBay's acquisition of Skype.
Yeah, it was. And really? They actually had
Wow.
They actually had a product in there that was along these lines. And
just a little bit of background. They paid a lot of money. I think it was like €1.5 billion approximately for Skype.
Yeah.
Something in that range. They bought this.
They paid a lot and then they wrote it off. Later,
yeah, and it was like
for a loss, and then Microsoft picked them up later for
it was like a big head scratcher to everybody. They're like, why would eBay buy Skype? But I think they were trying to set up exactly this. It was like a brokered marketplace for professional services, right, where people could use Skype to connect. I guess
that's my understanding. And they actually had some paid features. You could actually do this, and there were cool. Some people that set up marketplaces. And the funny thing is, I actually found this out about 2 weeks. I'd already given notice at my job, and I was
at Green Hill.
Yeah, at Green Hills. And I gave notice to my boss, and he didn't want me to leave. So he said, you know what? I'm not going to tell HR. I'm going to wait until, I think it was like Monday, the next Monday. I'll wait until the next Monday. And then if you haven't said anything to me, then I'll tell HR.
Tell HR, okay.
And that Saturday night, James calls me up and said, hey, I was doing some Googling, and I found like 50 zillion competitors to the thing that we're building.
Okay.
And he sent me the links, and I went through them. And at the time, I thought competition mattered, and I freaked out. Well, and I almost called my boss and like called the whole thing off because
yeah. Well, competition is actually it's an interesting topic by itself because on one hand it means that you're doing something that there's at least some market for, right? Otherwise, there wouldn't be all these competitors there.
At this point, I consider competition in the marketplace to be a good thing because exactly what you say, it indicates that
there is a market or there's something, right? At least a lot of people think that, you know. But I guess it can be bad in cases where there's kind of a winner-take-all situation or you're coming a little late to the game, right?
If there's one big dominant player, that might be worse. But I don't think most entrepreneurs should worry too much about competition.
I see.
If you have something that'll differentiate you, you can get customers anyways. If the product is useful, if your market, you know, exists.
Sure. So you found a lot of competitors. So, like, what was your reaction to that at the time?
I panicked. I thought that mattered. I thought if anyone had started the idea that there was no point in us trying, that they would win. Mm-hmm. I found out later that was a very silly reaction. I still think this should be done by someone.
Well, I mean, you know, looking back, it makes sense at the time why you felt that way, right?
It does, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting because, like, you know, there's all these lessons of startups out here, like with the lean startup movement and Y Combinator and all this. And there's this huge body of institutional knowledge that you eventually pick up, you know, and everybody comes at this from a different angle and they all come with like a different set of preconceptions, you know, and that was one that you had apparently.
I think this is actually one that a lot of people have. A lot of people think that the main thing that kills a business is competition and that they need to keep their idea secret.
Yeah.
And the process isn't like that at all. It's not nearly as cutthroat as... Mm-hmm. You know, not it's a cutthroat in different ways, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's not the kind of thing where, you know, trying to be secretive and getting patents and that kind of thing is going to build a business. You
really
build a business by talking to customers and building something that's valuable. And if you get to the point where, you know, IP and secrecy matter, you've already won.
Yeah.
And no matter how it works out, you're going to be
because it means you have something that other people want, right?
Right.
Or that there's a big enough deal. Yeah.
Yeah, and it turns out if you've gotten to that stage,
uh-huh.
you already have a very valuable business. Most startups never get to the phase of having something that other people want.
Sure. So you didn't end up building the professional services thing, but you still did leave Green Hills.
I did. Yeah.
Right. On schedule.
I did not change my mind.
Okay.
I had another idea I've been throwing around for a long time, which was basically a hardware device for your smartphone that would allow you to, in real time, authenticate credit card transactions. Basically,
cool.
you would attach this thing to your smartphone, and then whenever you use your credit card, we would tie in at the credit card processor level, and we would alert your cell phone that a transaction was going to take place and allow you to approve or reject it with your fingerprint.
Is that equivalent to something that Square is working on right now, I suppose?
Kind of, right? But I guess before we get into that, like... Where do these ideas come from? Like, how do you get startup ideas?
So I actually kept a list all through college. I started this freshman year, okay. and I maintained this with actually several other friends, and we had a sort of collaborative list of every time any idea popped in our heads of something think we should be built, we put in this list. And basically, when I started thinking I should leave my company, I just went and looked at the list and I said, what's the best one on here?
I have a document in Google Docs called Opportunities. Same kind of thing, right?
Yep.
Why doesn't this exist?
Very familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so you have this list of 100 ideas and you say, okay, I'm going to do a startup and let's sort it by expected value and pick the best one. So that's what I did. And then when that one didn't work, I went down the list, basically.
Okay. And then the sort process is interesting, too, because you've got to have an idea that I think you care about, and that you're capable of executing.
Right. And that you can get your partner on board with.
Yeah, exactly. Or whoever else is involved. And there's a lot of different dimensions to this. The market has to be sufficiently large. You have to have the right capital intensity. Like, you can't start a company that makes airplanes. At least, I don't think so. But maybe somebody would figure that out.
You need to raise a little more money.
Yeah, right? A couple billion.
Not angel financed.
Right. So you took the second one, I guess, on the list. So the first one was the professional services thing, and you shied away from that from the competition, you said. Huh?
That's right.
That's interesting. So the second one was what? That was the credit card thing. And I guess the idea behind that was that you wanted to make sure that credit card fraud wasn't a problem for people?
Yeah. So we thought of credit card fraud as this major issue, and we wanted to stop it. And we thought, I had a solution that was, I'd spent a lot of time doing encryption work at school. I took a couple of encryption classes. I thought it was really exciting. I love doing cryptography work, and I thought the solution to credit card fraud would be a highly secure, like cryptographically secure
stable
solution
thing. You know, PayPal started kind of similarly to this. I don't know if you know that.
I do. They had a hardware device.
Yeah, they had a hardware device, but I think
I saw Max Levchin give a talk about it.
Yeah, they started off. It was something with payments with phones or something, right? I'm not sure exactly.
Yep, I got the whole story. It's kind of that's kind of a funny story in itself. You guys should interview Max at some point and tell his story.
Oh, maybe we'll get Max. That's a little ambitious. So you did that, and I know you told me that you bought a lot of hardware, right? Like a whole ton of hardware to get started with this.
Yeah, I bought...
And you weren't sure whether this is something people would want, but you just started building it right away, right?
Yep, I bought a microcontroller. I bought a PIC. I think a PIC, like a development kit for PIC.
I've built PICs myself, actually.
And I bought...
Did you program it in C or assembly?
I don't remember. and I bought $2,500 in fingerprint sensing parts.
Okay.
I called up a couple of contractors and got them to like give me price quotes for.
So you were like going
board.
Whole hog on this thing, huh?
I thought I was just going to build this thing, and then when I was done, I just sell it.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what I was doing.
That's very honest of you, Andrew.
And most of this time while I was doing this, my co-founder was off in Asia, and he was participating over email, but. He wasn't really around, so most of this was me kind of fumbling around in the dark.
This was between September and December?
This was... No, I quit my job in December. December 15th of 2007.
Okay.
I quit my job.
Okay.
And no, from December until early May.
Okay.
It was just me.
Okay.
And working not real hard. I was having fun with it. And I was coaching at the time. I spent a lot of time coaching.
You were coaching gymnastics, right?
That's right.
So that was your side job.
That got me out of the house.
I see. That's nice. So it was for high school students, I think, or
no,
was
it was all ages. So I had a team of girls from like youngest was 7 or 8, and oldest was 17.
Okay, and was it like a local gym or where
yeah,
was
just,
it?
Yeah, just a local gym.
Okay, that's a nice thing to do. I think that a lot of people that work really hard in technology don't have that kind of side thing, and it's even better when your side thing even pays a little bit of money, right?
It helped keep me sane for a while.
Sure, because you were working completely by yourself, right? And
until
out of your own house, or
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's amazing. So you know, I realize it's difficult because I did this for a while. Like, you just get up in the morning.
People
you know.
Think that the working from home is awesome. Working from home is terrible.
Yeah, it is, because like you don't leave the house all day.
You're either always at work or always at home.
Uh huh.
So you either get nothing done or you can't relax.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of hygiene around like the separation between work and home, which can get really
right.
difficult.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, you get food everywhere.
Yeah, like exactly. Food all over the place, and you do your laundry in the middle of the day. You know, and you know you're not ever really home in the sense that you're away from work. You know, like. You're always kind of at work perpetually. It can get tough. When I was in Seattle, I became a member at a co-working space to avoid this. It was a couple $100 a month extra, but I think
it's definitely
it's
worth
well,
it.
Well worth it. So then, you told me that James eventually told you this wasn't working, huh? So he was the voice of reason in this one?
Yeah, so he came out in May, and actually made the home living thing even more ridiculous. We ended up sharing a room.
okay.
His
with your
room
co-founder.
Became the office, and he slept in my room. And,
okay.
This actually made for lots of great jokes.
Okay.
The bed he slept on was actually, I owned it.
Okay, so he was sleeping in your bed.
He was sleeping in my bed, right? So that's how my roommates would introduce us as, yeah, this is Andrew and this is the guy that sleeps in his bed.
that's awesome.
He successfully convinced a lot of people that we were, you know, gay lovers. But
yeah, of course, right? You guys had a shared bank account too, you know, and you lived in the same house, and
we shared money.
He slept in your bed, so yeah, it was a bit of a marriage, but you know, so it goes.
True,
right?
Partners in startup.
Yep, right. Yep, it's hard to tell the difference. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. So that's good. So then eventually you shut that down, and then what was the next thing you did after that?
So around July, so James came out in early May, and we spent May, June, and most of July working on this. And most of that time was actually spent building a giant 70-page business plan where we projected, where we projected that within 2 years we'd have $1 billion in revenue.
Okay.
And we had all these like ludicrous, like James had taken a lot of like business classes, so he,
okay, mm-hmm,
he had all of these, you know,
ideas about business.
Yeah,
right?
He had like the five forces model where you can like model your competition.
Porter's five forces model.
Yeah,
I think it's
are you
called.
Familiar with this?
Yeah,
he had all this thing. This business plan was full of stuff.
Like 2x2 matrices and SWOT analyses.
Yep, we had SWOT analysis. Yep,
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we had all this stuff, and we took it to this local group. Forget what they're called. It's like retired CEOs, and they get together.
Yeah, I think I've heard of this.
I'm forgetting the name, but we took extra business plan to them, and they were there at this and said, "Oh, great! You have a SWOT analysis, and you have you know, five forces, and all these things, which are probably great for some types of businesses, but for what we were doing, which was completely hopeless, it was not. They should have just told us, you know, you're crazy. Yeah. Stop this."
Now, in general, is that what startups do to pitch to venture capitalists here?
I think it's being reinvented right now.
The business plan?
No, just the way entrepreneurship works. You know, it's in the process of being reinvented.
It is.
And made better.
It is. If I walked into a VC's office with a printed business plan, they would laugh me out of the office.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, they just want a slide deck, right?
They want a slide deck. So the best ones, Sequoia actually.
And a demo.
And a demo. Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you don't have a working product when you walk in there, like, you're never going to get
this.
This
isn't 2000 anymore.
But one of the guys from Sequoia actually talked to us last summer, and he tried to talk us into, you know, pitching with no slide deck. He wanted you just to talk. And I don't know if I have the confidence to do that, but that was actually what he said. So no deck, no business plan, just come in and tell them about your startup.
Yeah, sure. And just know it well enough that you can do that and not have to rely on the deck. Because the thing about presentations always is that, you know, they're referred to as visual aids, but I think in some sense they're not an aid. A lot of people use them, and it's a bit more like note cards almost. It's like you're just reading note cards off the wall.
Could you just read through the bullet point that you present in the slide deck? And
yeah,
it
kind
of
gets
it helps for people who aren't amazing presenters. It helps with the structure of their talk, which is why I like them.
Mm-hmm. So the second company, like what did it do? Tell me about it.
So the second one, basically, when we figured out this first one wasn't working, James figured it out first and took a few weeks to convince me that it definitely was not working. And he had an idea, and I said, "Well, okay, it's your turn."
Okay.
So we
come up with an idea, James.
Well, he already had the idea. Basically, he had lost some stuff. He lost his cell phone at a bar in Wisconsin when he was visiting.
Okay.
And he thought, you know, why can't we use the internet to help us find stuff, find lost items? And so we worked on this project called Send Me Home, where you could label all of your objects with these, you know, codes. And then anyone who went to our website could type in that code and they could return the item to the owner. And it had this whole kind of social aspect, a lot like a company that came along later, a little more famous company called Sticky Bits.
Okay, I think I've heard of Sticky Bits, actually.
The founders there eventually started Turntable FM.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, which is obviously very well known here.
Right.
This was in like 2009 that you were working on this project, or 2008?
This was in 2008 we started working
2008.
On this.
2008, okay.
2008 and then early 2009. And
yeah,
the social aspect behind this was that you could have items where when you lose them, you didn't intend them to come back to the owner. You just wanted to sort of document their journey. And so each person, when they typed in the code, they'd be prompted to add some pictures and have a blog post and like share their story.
That's cool. So it's a bit like the tracking dollar bills.
Where's George? Where's George? But for any item.
For any item.
And we actually had some items do some pretty cool things. We had one item that went to Obama's inauguration. It went to Mardi Gras in New Orleans. It went to the Great Wall of China.
Okay.
And a bunch of other places.
Wow. Okay. So and this got some mentions, I think. Like, I remember reading on LinkedIn that it was like noted in Business Week, I think, right?
We had a lot of press, actually. So we launched on Lifehacker. I remember right. And at one point, actually, TechCrunch wrote about us.
Okay, cool. And
we got a lot of people picking it up from that. And at the end of 2009, we ended up getting a mention in PC World. As okay. They picked us as the 64th best product of 2009. And we were ahead of Dropbox.
That's incredible.
Wow. Which is, which is incredible. The best thing ever. And the funny thing was, at that point, we had already given up. We already knew this thing wasn't working.
Okay.
And we were sort of looking for ways to transition out of it.
Okay.
And this thing came out, and we said, great, we can call our competition and say, hey, how would you like to, you know, buy up a product that's better than Dropbox? You know, we'll do it for cheap, and then we can move on to our next product, and you guys can...
Yeah, and you did end up selling it, right?
Yeah, so there were a couple of companies bidding for it. One was a startup, and who actually, their founders have started a new company called Memory Lane now here in San Francisco, and then the other one was an established company called Track It Back that
okay.
sells these labels in stores worldwide, and they were offering cash, so...
Cool.
We took the cash offer.
So you took the money. Cool.
We took the money.
That's really great. And then I imagine you put some of that into your third company.
That's right.
This is amazing, by the way. This is your third company. You're like 28 years old now.
Hey, right? You know, we kept telling ourselves, you know, 9 out of 10 are supposed to fail, right? So we only have, you know, N more to go until it succeeds. So we're on number 3 right now.
You just moved on in your opportunities.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have to fail 6 more, and then one of them mm-hmm. will work.
So your third one, you target it toward musicians, but it was a chat product, right?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say it's targeted for musicians. It was okay. It was intended originally for blogs. Was okay. the original sure. audience, and it was a chat product that looked a lot like Facebook's chat.
Okay.
And let you talk with other people, not that who are your friends, but other people who are at the same websites. And the thought process there was, you know, there's lots of people all over the internet like reading the same stories as you, but you can't see them. You can't mm-hmm. interact with them. They're looking at the same thing as you are, but you know, if you went to a convention and you went to a booth at that convention and you were the only person in the convention hall, that would seem like strange and lonely. So why, when we're on this convention hall of the internet, do we not get to see the other people who are at the same booths as
you? And I think there's some of this, right? Like a lot of blogs and other news articles have comment streams and things like that, but it's not real time.
It's not real time. It's not real time, and it doesn't let you do things like branch off into a private conversation.
Right. And it's more long form and kind of asynchronous, right? It's not like standing there and talking to somebody.
And it persists. So one of the problems with comments is people are afraid to leave comments around because, you know, it might come back to haunt them later. Someone might come along later and, you know, see what you wrote, and if it was something, you know, not insightful or angry or something, you might regret it. Whereas with something like chat, the histories don't live around very long. And so you're okay having those discussions, especially if it's a private conversation.
Is that the expectation that you communicate to your users, that this will be off the record, like it'll just disappear in a while?
So we have a couple different kinds of chats. There are public chats that exist on the web page that do let you see, you know, what other people have said and go back in the history a fair amount. But it's not forever. And in our experience, most people don't scroll up. They just see the new stuff as it comes in. But then we also have private chats where the expectation is that it's off the record just between those people and that we don't release any of those transcripts. And
I see.
You know, it's only with people that you share it with.
So then for these chats, like how many people participate in these? Like one or two or five? Or like how does it work?
It really varies. So the one-on-one chats are generally one-on-one. The private chats are generally one-on-one.
Okay.
But you can invite as many people as you want into those. The public chats really vary in size. So on most websites, it might be a few people, but on... you know, bigger like celebrity websites, you might have hundreds of people in a single chat. So one of the first big sites that we were on was Limp Bizkit's website.
Limp Bizkit.
Nice. Limp Bizkit. That was one of the first big ones.
Cool.
And when Fred Durst tweeted about the chat, we had hundreds of people show up in this chat room.
Yeah. Did it break?
No, it worked just fine. Although cool. Fred Durst said he hated it.
He hated what?
He did. James opened up a private chat with him, and he said, "What is this terrible chat? I hate it." But he left it on his website, and he continued to pay us. So
okay.
apparently, he didn't hate it too much. Mm-hmm.
And then,
in terms of identity, like, are people tied to the Facebook or Google identity, or can people just chat as anonymous?
So we don't. We tried to stay out of that business, right? We tried to let the website owners hook that up however they wanted. So if they wanted to tie in with Facebook, we had some tools to let them do that. If they wanted to have it use their own authentication systems, we let them do that. It turns out the vast majority of people using the chat actually use our API to allow people to sign in.
To authenticate.
like with their own login. So we're very popular, especially on CMSs that have a plugin system, because we can do that API part automatically. So we're very big on WordPress and vBulletin and Drupal.
And just to be clear, like this is a pretty tough problem, because you have to have a bunch of people that are all connected at the same time. And I think you guys handle in some cases like tens of thousands or more of concurrent connections, right? Like no problem.
Yeah, we do.
So you've got all these people that are like all connected to your server at the same time, and all these messages are being passed around between all these people. You know, so it gets a little tough, right?
So because of the problem that you refer to, and you know, the fact that we have to, you know, do the messaging in ways that are not sort of optimal, because we're on a web browser, we have to do what's called long polling to support most browsers. We end up handling tens of thousands of HTTP requests every second across a bunch of servers.
Every second you handle tens of thousands of requests.
That's right.
That's incredible. And you wrote the whole thing in Java, right, on Jetty, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yeah, okay. The chat's all on
Java. And you wrote your own web server for this, right?
No. So Jetty is it's a Java servlet container, mm-hmm. and it's designed specifically for doing asynchronous I/O.
I see.
Type stuff. It's designed for doing things like long polling.
Yeah, and when I heard about this, I you know, the first words out of my mouth were like, you should use Node, but this came out before Node was popular, right? This was 2008 or 2009.
We started working on this in 2009.
Yeah,
so
I think Node had just started.
Might have just started, but I'm sure it wasn't usable at that point.
Yeah, until last year, you know, Node wasn't even that big. The community wasn't that big as, you know, until...
Yeah, people around it.
Last year, so...
Yeah. Sure. So that's good. So then... You know, what's the evolution into Firebase? That's your new product, right? And that's the really exciting thing that you're working on now.
Definitely. So basically, the chat's gone very well, and we have a lot of websites using it. We're on about 60,000 sites right now.
60,000
sites.
Damn. And then are most of those people paying, or how does that work?
Most of those are free.
Okay.
And it turns out the distribution is actually, there's a few very big sites.
Okay.
And then tons of little sites. And most of our money comes from, you know, the top few.
The really big ones.
And basically what we figured out was...
Andrew, just real quickly, that's an interesting point, because a lot of startups are trying this model now where they have like a very hands-off sales process, you know, and there's been a lot of discussion about this recently about, you know, whether you should try to have like a lot of smaller customers or a lot of bigger people, and people complain, you know, they don't like talking to salespeople about pricing and stuff, but turns out actually that's where a lot of companies make their money, right, is on the bigger end of things.
There's a trade-off. So small customers are nice. I think they lead to a kind of a more fun like company to build.
Yeah,
they're maybe a little more fun to interact with. There's much less hand holding that you need to do with them. Self serve is awesome. I get emails every day when people sign up. I do nothing, and the money just kind of comes in.
Yeah,
which is really nice. But one big customer can be as big as 100 small customers.
I see.
And so when you have the option of, you know, let's say with, you know, Universal Music's one of our big customers. If we have the option of, you know, maybe putting in a couple extra features to make sure that they have what they need, it's the same as, you know, getting maybe 100 of these small customers.
I see. So tell me about the current company, man. It's pretty exciting. You're about to launch a pretty big product.
Yeah. So what we discovered when we were building this chat product is, one, that the customers with all the money were a few of the big ones. And two, that those customers needed a lot of customization that we just couldn't provide them. They kept asking for new features and new customizations, and for a long time we'd add more checkboxes and dropdowns and options for them to have what they needed, but it got to the point where they'd have requests that really didn't fall into the scope of the chat product that we were building. And so we sat down and had a long, hard think about this, and we figured out that sort of the extreme of customization is a full development platform. You know, rather than trying to build every feature for them, why don't we just expose an API to them and let them build it themselves? Because one of the nice things about these big customers is, you know, the big, you know, big Facebook games and the music sites and those kind of things.
They're pretty savvy, right?
They're savvy, and they have their own developers, and they don't have enough developers to build like a full chat system, but they do have enough to customize the GUI and that sort of thing.
I see.
So
and they probably want that anyway, because they want to offer a more branded experience, right?
Exactly. And they might, you know, they might have... One of the things that we got asked a lot for is people want access to the data. We have all these chat transcripts, and we provided a nice GUI to get at them, but we didn't have any sort of API. And people wanted to, you know, to do things like, you know, market to these people. You know, this person mentioned this product. I'd like to throw an ad, you know, tied to that product, or I'd like to give them, you know, they have a game and they want to like give them virtual points for like doing certain types of things in chat. How can we make that happen?
Yeah.
And we thought real hard about, you know, how do we make this possible? And it there really wasn't a good way for us to expose all this and still have this chat product. So we said, great, we're just going to build this full like development product for building chat.
Right. And the other important trend here that we haven't talked about much is the coming of the real-time web. So, you know, whereas the web used to be just about making an HTTP request and getting a full web page down, you know, increasingly now you don't have to go all the way to the server to get more information. The users expect that the new stuff will be pushed to them automatically.
It's right? true. Yeah.
So you guys enable that.
We do. And this is kind of why what we figured out was the reason that these developers are using us. They were able to build their own GUIs. And they actually, in a lot of cases, preferred to build their own GUIs.
On top of your chat product, or?
Just in general. Okay. Just in general. But the thing that they couldn't do was that real-time distribution of data.
Okay.
Which is what, you know,
so the problem really here, just to be clear, is that you've got a bunch of data, and a bunch of people are sort of looking at it or observing it, you know, and then one party can change some piece of information in this whole giant collection, you know, and then everybody wants to know when it's changed, right? So, yeah, I mean, you can imagine using this to look at, like, the weather outside, you know, over like a huge geographic area, or maybe like a set of stock prices even, right, if people are trading, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And this problem turns out it's a very hard problem to solve, especially if you have multiple parties changing that object. So in the example you had, if 1,000 people are watching and one person makes a change, and you're doing this over long polling, which is a very common technique doing this in the browser, that means you have to send 1,000 HTTP requests for every change that's made. Now, let's say all 1,000 of those people are updating that object. You have to do 1,000 squared HTTP requests, you know, every n amount of time to handle that.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that, you know, most people just don't know how to build a software that can do this.
It's a pretty specialized area of expertise, right?
This is one of the reasons that Node is so popular, is because it enables, you know, developers that might not be experts in this topic to actually build, like, asynchronous event-driven software and build things that scale very well.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. So okay, so what's next then? I guess you're going to launch this product on when, you said April 13th.
So the press date is April 13th.
Okay.
And we're intending to tell the world about it. Although I don't think we're going to be able to invite everyone to the beta just yet.
Okay. So it'll come out and there'll be a limited beta for a while.
Yeah, so we already have a number of companies in beta.
Okay.
And we're going to open that up a little wider on the 13th, as well as sort of publish our docs and let people take a look.
Yeah, and just to be clear, your intention with this is that it'll be like a full database platform. So, you know, you can write your mobile application or your website or whatever, and you won't need to host it on Heroku or on like .cloud or any of these other systems. Like, it'll just talk directly to your service, right?
Exactly. So actually do is we provide a synchronized data structure that you can access through a simple library that you include in your application.
Mm-hmm.
And any changes that you make to that data structure propagate automatically to everyone else who has the same data structure, and also propagates to our servers where we save that data. So we act as both a database and a communication layer, and we do synchronization like between all
the
clients.
That's incredible. And you have some pretty good demos. You know, one of them is the race car, where you show a race car on a mobile, and then people can turn the mobile device, and then the race car will pivot on another screen, like remotely. Right.
Yeah. You can use your phone as a steering wheel.
Yeah.
As a game controller,
and it works in real time. You know, with a website, right? Like no native app, no nothing, just a website.
Yep.
That's pretty awesome. And then what are some of the other ones? I think you had a Tetris game too, right? Where two people can play a game at the same time.
Yeah. So the most popular demos are the games. Tetris is great. If I'm meeting with a customer or an investor, I can sit down and I can play Tetris with them for 5 minutes, and then at the end of that, they already love it because they love Tetris.
That's cool.
Now, you mentioned a bit earlier that, you know, whenever startups, they work on a good idea, there's always competitors in the same space. So who do you think are the competitors in this space, and, you know, how do you differentiate yourself from them?
Yeah, so there's a couple broad categories of competitors. There's people who are doing real-time services.
Okay.
And there are people that are doing sort of a back-end as a service type approach. And on the real-time side, the big ones are people like PubNub and Pusher. And there's some others. Beacon Push, I think, was one of them. There's another number of others. And they focus on doing a PubSub service. You can send out messages to large numbers of people. But on the other side, you have people like Heroku, App Engine, StackMob.
Right.
And they provide a persistence layer and like a backend for your application. We actually sort of sit in the middle between the two of these.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide both the persistence layer and the real-time messaging, and we let you build fully collaborative applications without any server infrastructure at all.
Yeah, that's amazing. I just want to say it blows my mind. This is possible. So, all right, that's about all we have time for tonight. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
And hope to talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
Engineers on Stage is produced by Ravi Satyam and David Albrecht of RND.io and is made available subject to the terms of Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 Unported, all other rights reserved. The full text of this interview is available on our website, RND.io. Thanks for listening.